time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Bert Sachs. Bert Sachs is with INOC, the Interfaith Network of Concern for the People of Iraq. In 1997, defying U.S. sanctions, he traveled to Iraq and delivered medicines to the people of Iraq. Because of those actions, for nearly a decade, he has been facing a $10,000 fine for violation of the Trading with the Enemy Act. On December 28th of last year, 2011, Judge Richard Jones of U.S. District Court in Seattle dismissed the case with prejudice. And he is here with us today. Bert, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
So talk about your case and your reason for defying the U.S. sanctions on Iraq. How did that all come about?
Well, to go back a little bit, or actually quite a bit in time, I first learned about the sanctions in a powerful way in 1994, where I was pointed to the New England Journal of Medicine. And the New England Journal powerfully, terribly, said, "We estimate that 46,900 children in Iraq have died excess deaths from January to August of 91, the first Gulf War." And that number stayed with me, has stayed with me all those years. And I said, can this be really happening? And I spent the next year trying to research and look into what might have explained this and how come nobody was talking about it here. The next powerful thing that happened, and I'll speak more about it in a minute, is friends knew that I was interested in this subject and lent me their television. I didn't have one at the time. And Madeleine Albright was appearing on a segment of 60 Minutes where Leslie Stahl and the team went to Iraq and recorded what was there. And what was there is what I came eventually to see myself, which is children dying in hospitals, malnutrition, mostly waterborne diseases, diarrhea, cholera, typhoid, dysentery. Because when we took out virtually all the electrical plants in Iraq in 91, they had no way of pumping water and pumping sewage. And just imagine 6 million people in Baghdad with no place for the sewage to go. It goes on the streets and the gutters and into the Tigris River and becomes the drinking water of people downstream. That was going on, and Madeleine Albright was asked by Leslie Stahl, "We've heard that 500,000 children have died. You know, is that, quote, worth the price?" Well, I'll read to you directly from Madeleine Albright's memoir called Madam Secretary, where she talks about this, and I'll give you her response to that question and her reaction to it. Mike can tell everyone I'm actually holding the book in my hand and I'm reading it.
He has
page the book. 275. Okay. And Madeleine Albright answers, "I think it is a very hard choice, but the price, we think, the price is worth it." 500,000 dead children, she says, "I think the price is worth it." Then she says, "I must have been crazy." And I'll talk more about this in a minute when I discuss what I want to say when I go to Martin Luther King Day workshop on Monday, which is paraphrasing Martin Luther King, who said, "The country of the greatest violence, the purveyor of the greatest violence in the world, is my own country." And I think he was killed, actually, a year from the date that he said that in Riverside Church. But I think it's important to say the purveyor of the greatest terrorism in the world is my own country. And I'll come back and read the next sentence from Madeleine Albright's book in a minute. But I want to go on to the third item, because unlike a lot of public figures, unfortunately, and a lot of politicians, if I'm talking about terrorism, we should know what the word means. So I'm going to quote to you now the third major event that took place, where all of this was before I went for the 1997 trip to Iraq, bringing $40,000 worth of medicines, the trip I was fined for. I went to see Kate Flaumer. Kate Flaumer is the U.S. federal attorney. And she's the woman who is in charge of, well, our legal system, who reported to Janet Reno in D.C. And after she left office, She wrote a very good opinion piece in the Seattle PI, and I want to quote from that next. And what she said was, this is her giving the definition of terrorism. Title 18, U.S. Code Section 2331, defines international terrorism as acts dangerous to human life when those acts are intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. You have it? It's saying, it doesn't say it has to be a violent act. You don't have to do it with bombs or bullets. Simply an act dangerous to human life, such as blowing up waterworks and electrical plants that people need for their survival, and doing it to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. Now, back to Madeleine Albright. After she says that the price was worth it, she said, I must have been crazy. I should have answered that question by reframing it and pointing out the inherent flaws in the premise behind it. Quote, Saddam Hussein could have prevented any child from suffering simply by meeting his obligations. End quote. Now, this book came out in 2003. She had a lot of time to think about what she said and the situation in Iraq. And what she says is, children wouldn't have died if Saddam just did what we told him to do. Now, it doesn't matter what we tell him to do, whether it's something legal in the sense that the United Nations Security Council had authorized it, such as to disarm, or something which violated the Security Council resolution, which is, we'll continue the sanctions until Saddam is overthrown. That's George Bush, that's James Baker. It was our official policy to disregard what the UN international law said in the Security Council. And if you disarm, we'll end the sanctions. And all of these people in our administration said no. Okay, so let me put it in plain, simple terms. What we are saying to this ruler, that we considered a ruthless ruler, is unless you allow yourself to be overthrown, perhaps assassinated, we're going to continue the sanctions, and children will continue to die. We're using the sanctions to coerce you, either for the official reason or for our reason, our agenda, and children will die. Now, that's an admission of terrorism. It's an admission that we intended to coerce this man through the suffering and death of children. And these were not a few. It was a massive amount of suffering. It was, according to UNICEF, eventually, in 1999, a couple years after that program on 60 Minutes, that UNICEF said 500,000 children had died in just the first 8 years. So, that's why I think it's quite easy to show that what we did to the Iraqi people was an act of international terrorism. And it went on from 91 to 2003, until we invaded the country. Well, with that said, let me take a sip of coffee and take a breath or two and get on to the next things I'd like to say. So, I should say, I can't easily do hyperlinks on the radio. It's a great resource, though. The computers that we have are a great source, as is alternative radio, as are programs like Yours, Mike, and Democracy Now!, and blogs you can read on the web to find out the kind of things that are not being covered in the main media. And I mentioned 500,000 dead children because that was a story that never appeared on the nightly news in the three major channels. Friends looked at the transcript of ABC, NBC, and CBS, and they did not find mention of UNICEF in that report in August of 1991 at all. Never. So that's why alternative ways of getting information out are so important. And so now to tell people who want to read actually the source from the UNICEF pages or Madeleine Albright's book that I scanned in that page where she has those quotes, they can go to IraqiKids.org. And by the end of the program, I hope to repeat it again. Because for once a month, I've posted a article concerning terrorism in the United States. And so that's 12 articles. And the last few months, I've quoted U.S. Air Force colonels who write quite candidly, quite amazingly, in U.S. Air Force air power journals from a major Air Force base, things that I think are self-incriminating and make the case that I'm trying to make here. I'm just using Madeleine Albright because people know her. They don't know, for example, Colonel John Warden or Kenneth Risser. But there's an article I post a few months ago by Kenneth Risser who admits that the policy of bombing electrical plants, quoting the New England Journal, produced all these epidemics of waterborne disease. And he asked the question, should the U.S. Air Force take this into consideration as they plan their strategy? And he goes through a lengthy, several thousand word paper and comes to a quite amazing conclusion. He said, yes, this policy led to the deaths of 100,000 Iraqi civilians. Now, first, that number is probably 10 times too low. And secondly, at least the majority of them were not just plain civilians. They were children under five, which is what the medical reports cover. Well, his conclusion is that, yes, he thinks this is all legal. And as long as he thinks it's legal, the U.S. Air Force should continue the policy or will continue the policy because, he's, in his terms, the Air Force has a, quote, vested interest in undermining civilian morale by doing this. Well, that deserves a deep breath and some more evidence of what we have done, because this was published, I think it was May. Anyhow, it was a few months before September 11th, 1991. I'm sorry, not 2001, September 11th, 2001. And the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi people, children, undermining civilian morale. Well, the rest of the world saw much more clearly, I believe, than what we saw here because of our media, which I'll get to now in just a minute, what was happening. So I encourage people to go to look at IraqiKids.org, to look at the sources, go back to the original sources, including Kenneth Risser's article and John Warden's article and Madeleine Albright and the other people that I cite. But let me go on now to the second and I think most interesting and difficult issue, which is how do we, as people that want to make this a better world, how do we look at all of this with enough wisdom so that we'll be motivated to keep doing it and we won't burn out and we won't be angry and we'll be effective? After all, what we want to do is to make the change, right? So let me take another breath, another drink of coffee, and get to that subject.
And by keep, when you say keep doing it, you mean resisting, questioning these things and resisting them?
Yes, exactly.
Policies?
Yeah, because frankly, when I would come back from Iraq, I made 9 trips to Iraq. That the one I was fined for, I really haven't gone into details. I should have mentioned earlier that I was fined for the trip $10,000 in the year 2002. It was a very good front-page story in the Seattle PI. And as a consequence of that, the headline I really liked, it was U.S. versus Bert Sachs's principles on Iraq. And the first sentence was the only one I had some objection to, which was written by the correspondent, the PI correspondent in Washington, D.C., where I was when I was saying why I won't pay the fine. It says, he looks like everyone's favorite grandfather. And that took me aback a bit because in 2002, I didn't quite see myself as a grandfather. But okay. As a consequence of that good story, lawyers eventually came to me and said, would I like free legal advice? And I said, yes. And in 2004, we turned around and we sued the federal government over the deaths of 500,000 children. And on that same blog, IraqiKids.org, you can go to Bert's case and you can read the story of that lawsuit from district court, a different judge, to appeals court, to a petition to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's particularly a conclusion where international law didn't prohibit us from doing what we did. I encourage people to look at that because I think the rule of law is clearly under attack in our country, and that's part of what we need to fight against. So, that said, let me come back to the issue that I want to try and address in the last part of the interview. Here we are. We look out at these things, and I would come back from Iraq, and I would be so angry. I'd seen the kids dying. I'd hear the dishonesty, and I'd see that none of the story of what was going on was really genuinely being covered. And we'd have some successes here and there, including with the Seattle Times on their editorial page. But by and large, nothing seemed to be changing. And it was eating me up, frankly. When you're angry for long periods of time, it's what the Buddhists call an afflictive emotion. Nobody goes away to workshops to learn how to be angry, right? So what do you do? Well, I frankly think that when people are angry like that and they try and speak out about it, there is a general reaction on the part of many people who say, I don't want that for myself. Well, I don't really want to be angry. I'm going to turn the television off, turn the radio off, stop reading, because what can I do anyhow? And this guy is just, you know, I don't want to be angry. I want my nice, comfortable life. So that's a reason I came to realize, along with what it was doing to me, that I needed to get a little wiser, maybe a lot wiser, in how to look at this. So here is my thinking about that issue. First, I've been trying to study the principles, the science, actually, of nonviolence. So let's begin with what violence is and where does it come from. And I'll give it to you in a very simple form. I think George W. Bush put it in a way that resonated with a lot of people in the country, in a simple way. He said, look, it's a dangerous world. There are a lot of bad guys out there. And, of course, we're the good guys. So let me say flat out that I think that's the root of violence. Once you divide the world into bad guys and good guys, then what you want to do is to do what, I'll read you this quote from Solzhenitsyn, which puts it very succinctly. Quote, if only it were all so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere, insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? Well, I think the first part of that, most people would understand and agree with, that if it were only so simple, even though we keep trying. I mean, we're now, over 10 years into a so-called war on terrorism. Well, terrorism first is a tactic. And does anyone think that we're going to eventually kill all the terrorists? An army commander said in Iraq, we are making terrorists faster than we can kill them. When you pursue a policy of terrorism and cause all these deaths, and then you go in with your military, people have probably seen the news on Afghanistan where soldiers, snipers, were seen urinating on the bodies of people in Afghanistan that they killed. What does that do? Imagine, if we could, just switching the tables for all of this and saying, how would we feel? How would we react if this was done to us? Okay. So, if I contend that seeing the world as good guys and bad guys is going to bring us to violence in some form, even if we just have it in our minds, it will come out in some, maybe even subtle ways, as expressions in what we say, and then eventually what we do. So, what happens is, with that perspective of the world, we end up simply arguing over who the bad guys are. And we may say, the administration may say, the bad guys are over there, it's Saddam Hussein. And people in the peace movement say, no, no, the bad guys are here, it's Dick Cheney, let's say, or Madeleine Albright. Well, I choose Madeleine Albright in a lot of her quotes simply because in one page of her book, she provides the evidence, I think, because she put her foot in her mouth way back in 60 Minutes in that program, providing the evidence that what we had done was actually to coerce Saddam Hussein to be, have him overthrown. And we killed an awful lot of children doing that. So how do I personally see Madeleine Albright? And I think this principle you can apply to whoever it is in your mind that you hold as the enemy, as the bad guy. And nonviolence, Gandhi, King, and Jesus, if you will, said, no, no. Gandhi said, it's not nonviolence until you love your enemy. That's Gandhi. And Martin Luther King was quoted in a movie that I saw last night called I Am, over at Keystone Friday Night Free Movies, a great venue with 150 people showing up. And King was quoted as saying about the white, angry, violent racists in the South, he was saying, we need to see these people not as evil people, but as wounded, hurt people, as people that we need to help, as people that need our help. Well, that's such a shift in our perspective. It's a profound shift in how we look at the world and the people that do bad things. Clearly, people do bad things. I think Madeleine Albright has done some terrible things. But to see these people as people that are needing our help, I'd like to just interject here now what I said last night at the movies of somebody I admire greatly, a friend actually, Sami Awad, to show how this is possible. He is a Palestinian Christian who lives in Bethlehem and is teaching nonviolence to the Palestinians. Not just nonviolence in the superficial physical way, that we don't throw stones, we don't shoot guns at the Israelis, but in a deeper way. And what he says is, when I wait in line at the checkpoints, and there's an Israeli soldier with his M15, and he's sometimes even abusing old people that come through, he needs my help. I need to help him to overcome his fear so that he'll act in a different way. This is a Palestinian saying, I need to help this Israeli soldier, because who can understand them, who is closer to them, but the Palestinians? And I'll say one more thing just to give credit to Sammy. The place where I met Sammy was at Auschwitz. I'd gone there for a Zen peacemaker retreat, and Sammy Awad, this Christian Palestinian, was there to understand this aspect of Jewish culture, Jewish mentality, that the Holocaust is so deeply embedded. And I admire him greatly for having done that. And if we could try and ask the questions, well, how do I see these other people? Not how do I blame them, not what epithet or what name can I use to call them, but how do I understand how it looks from their eyes will be more effective and more peaceful and more nonviolent in working with them. So, let me come back to Madeleine Albright. As I was reading her book and thinking, well, how do I understand her? Two thoughts came to my mind about myself. Okay. In the 70s, I can remember people, I don't remember the circumstance, it was maybe a program or an article or a book even, about what we were doing in Central and South America, we the United States government. And I can remember the thought going through my head, I don't want to know about that. Okay? Why didn't I want to know? Well, I've got my nice, comfortable life. I was doing this and doing that. And early in the 70s, I was still an engineer in a profession. And I didn't want to know because I'd have to do something. And also because I didn't want to have to think of my country in a different way. I was brought up like most of us were, thinking, well, we're a good country, we're basically good guys, and so I didn't want to know about it. And then in the 80s, I can remember just where I was standing, where I saw the New York Times front page picture of a graph of temperature on the planet, and was my first awareness of global warming. And I remember looking at that picture and thinking, well, okay, as soon as the government passes regulations, I'll abide by them. But we'd flown from North Carolina to the Bay Area to visit friends, and people should know flying is like driving a Hummer that same distance in terms of impact. And I didn't want to know because I didn't want to have to change what I was doing. Well, those are aspects of what was in me that will help me identify with Madeleine Albright. And you can say, well, I never did anything as bad as she's done. Yeah, but I was never in a position or the circumstances in my life were different that led me to where I am. So I think that nonviolence calls on us to look out at the people and people that are doing things that are hurtful and begin by being honest about ourselves, being introspective, being truthful about what goes on in our minds, which is one of the things meditation is good at. You'll sit and you'll watch the things that go through your mind, the thoughts that go through your head, and you say, oh my gosh, is that me? And who are we as people? All of this involves a shift in the conventional way of looking at the world. It's not abstract. It's not pie in the sky. It is, I think, really a science. And there are people, especially in the East, who've been studying the science of the inner workings of our mind for a long, long time. And I think we can learn things from them. And science in the West is beginning to study these things, and I think those are all good. So my encouragement to people who are listening is to take this question of nonviolence. There are a lot of good sources. MetaCenter.org is one of them that I've gone down to the Bay Area to study about. And if people want more information about what I've been saying and covering here, IraqiKids.org is my source. And finally, I wanted to mention that for people that would like to come and challenge me and ask questions and have a discussion about this, I'm hoping we can do that at the Martin Luther King Day event on Monday at Garfield High School. And at 9:30, I'll be giving a workshop which is entitled The Greatest Purveyor of Terrorism on Our Planet is My Own Country. Come and join in the discussion.
We're talking with Bert Sachs. He is with INOC, the Interfaith Network of Concern for the People of Iraq. And you can find out more via Bert's website, IraqiKids.org. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as you just said, Monday, really quick because we need like 30 seconds. Right. So your case is over. Is this your focus now? Is
Unless the government appeals, they have 60 days until the end of February to appeal the judge's decision to dismiss the case. But if they don't appeal, then our suit against the government was over in 2007, and the government suit against me will be over in March of this year.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us again this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Again, just talking with Bert Sachs. He is with the Interfaith Network of Concern for the People of Iraq. And you can find out more about his work at his website, IraqiKids.org, or come to the workshop this coming Monday morning at 9:30 a.m. at Garfield High School.
All right.